Welcome to the We Talk Careers podcast, brought to you by Women in ETFs. This is Christine Delano, and I'm thrilled you've joined me. If you're pursuing excellence in your own career or intrigued by the hustle required for a career on Wall Street, this podcast is for you. We've made all this advice accessible. Grab your own Thrive Guide with a workbook on leadership skills at christinedelano.com. So put aside that massive to-do list and let's get inspired. Today, we're speaking to leaders who can both geek out on data and translate the big picture of our economy. They are the head of research at Issuers. From strategic planning to market analysis to industry trends, how do their roles guide the creation and management of ETFs? That's what we're going to find out. We have Matt Dines and Carol Spain with us today. Welcome, both of you, to the We Talk Careers podcast.
Thanks for having me, Christine.
Thank you.
Wonderful. Carol, let's start with you. Please introduce yourself to our listeners.
Hi, I'm Carol Spain. I'm head of credit research at Charles Schwab Asset Management. And I oversee a team of analysts who support our active fixed income strategies. So we cover both corporate and municipal analysis for our money market funds, other mutual funds, separately managed accounts, and ETFs.
Wonderful. Carol, and what about a little bit about your life? What keeps you busy outside of your walls?
Okay, so I'm based in Chicago, and I'm married with two small children. So one's in first grade, and I have one just about to turn four. So they can keep me very busy, but when I can, I do try to get some tennis in a couple of days a week. And I'm also a commissioner on our local park district board.
Oh, fantastic. Well, congratulations. That sounds like a really great way to make sure that you're seeing more of your outdoors is by actually being responsible for it. That's fantastic.
Yes. And I have kids as well. So it works out. We also oversee, many of the youth activities and then the actual parks and recreation aspects in our community. And so having small children, our whole family is just a regular active participant.
Oh, that's fantastic. I think finding things that really integrate into your family is so important because then it doesn't act like just another job that you have to do. I was really involved in Young Life when my kids are coming up. They're older than yours and such youth mentoring and all the activities around it. It dovetailed really well with our kids' phase of life. And then, of course, I can't give it up, so I'm still continuing to be involved. But Matt, can you tell us about yourself?
Yep. So Matt Dines, I'm co-founder and CIO of a firm called Build Asset Management. Along those CIO hats, we're a small buy-side firm. So you mentioned head of research that falls under my umbrella, as well as portfolio management. So a little different between Carol's background at a large firm. We're small and niche. So we run SMAs, pooled investment funds within ERISA, as well as an exchange-traded fund. Full disclosure, Christine is on its board.
I am.
And we've also launched a private fund recently as well. So just across the gamut of different vehicles that you can launch fixed income and credit investments in, we're kind of checking all those boxes. But we founded this firm, one of my partners and I, longtime friends, John Ruth, who I grew up with in Missouri. And, basically, I don't want to replay the whole background of my career, but graduating and entering kind of the industry in 2008, we kind of got a trial by fire, if you will. And as we've navigated that process coming out of that, things just started not looking right to us from an internal metrics perspective about fixed income and credit being able to maintain their purchasing power. So as we kind of navigated through the big events of the 2010s, right, multiple QEs, a European debt crisis, et cetera, that ultimately materialized in COVID. We were doing the groundwork to get ready for that and within fixed income. And that's kind of been our niche, is one of the few options that were built out, I think, from a small shop perspective to navigate that kind of environment that we've worked our way through in the last 12 to 18 months. So that's career. Family-wise, happily married. We just had our 10-year anniversary with my wife, Jen. Boys who just turned 9, twin boys. So that's kind of my real life's work and passion and joy. Just to talk about fun moments, as much as we put into work, I think those small things that you enjoy with your kids, like seeing them get involved in soccer as they're getting older, and watching Premier League games this weekend with the kids and seeing them really, really enjoy that. I think it's just those type of fun moments that I really live for. And then in addition to that, I think hobbies would include just fitness. I have a small group I work out with here in Seattle, and just try to kind of take care of ourselves as we age. So that's kind of my life and list of priorities.
Super important. I was just at the gym with my husband last night, and my back is like a little bit hurting me. So he is so much better at the gym than I am, but I go. So like that to me is just the win that I'm after. Ski season is a little bit more my jam, and certainly the rest of my family. And it's just great to have activities that you can do together and that you can grow with your kids in doing. And yeah, so I love that both of you have those kind of families, because it's just it's so rewarding. So Carol, we have a challenging goal ahead of us in this episode. In the span of 30 minutes or so, we are going to try to understand what a head of research does. So maybe start by giving us a peek at what a day in the life of you looks like.
Okay, so my day, every day, always starts out with following the news. That's kind of my routine in the morning, is to just get caught up on what happened overnight and how to prepare myself for the events of the day. And that's also how I wind down my day. So very important as head of research, you know, one of my jobs is to really oversee the quality of research on our team, make sure that we're responding to events that come up throughout the day, and really serve as a spokesperson for what's going on in fixed income credit. So, you know, it's very important for me to just have an overarching view of like what I think about credit at any given moment. But also as head of research, part of my job is to, you know, manage the team. So I have a lot of different opportunities that come up over the day to meet with my team. So we have credit committees that I participate in, as well as credit discussions, both for corporate credit and municipal credit. And then I also serve as kind of a liaison with senior management to discuss, you know, what they need to understand about fixed income. And I also participate in, you know, outreach to clients, you know, that might turn out to be a webcast or a call with our RIAs.
Wonderful. Thank you, Carol. And what about you, Matt? Does that look same or different in your role?
A little bit the same, a little bit different. So I'll start out, I'm on the West Coast. I work out of Seattle, which, you know, East Coast has it great. And the fact that markets start at 9:30. So, you know, you can get kids up, out the door, you know, to school, all of that with their lunches packed, ready to go, and still kind of maintain some degree of sleeping in, I guess, you know, early start 6 a.m., 7 a.m., but it can work on the East Coast. West Coast, it starts early. So 4 a.m., you got to be up, ready, responding to the news, what happened in Tokyo, what happened in London, same thing that Carol was doing, but it's just shifted forward. So you got to be early to bed or early to rise. It's just the trade-off you make living out here. So just getting ready, positioning yourself. What are the key economic prints? And that's before markets open at 6:30 a.m. my time. So markets are open for a lot of people before rush hour even starts here. So that's the start of the day. And then from there, it's just mapping your client account mandates to take advantage of interest rate moves, whatever happened, you know, different credit developments and so on. You know, that'll take up most of the trading day. And within credit, it comes in ebbs and flows. You just get big waves of order flow, if you will, just bids wanted, offers wanted. They usually come at once. So as those come up, you want to be ready to respond to those in your tools. But then throughout the day, as it ebbs and flows, you do have some time to catch up on the research. So it's mainly consuming research from the time market hours are open. And then once we flip over to market close at 1 p.m. here, then priority shift towards mid office, back office type stuff, checking through with the team, making sure everything goes through. Once that's done, then it's your chance to get ahead on the real front brain work that takes really active management, active thought, in terms of, you know, trying to come up with that research to stay, you know, one step of the market is all you really need to try to be. Too many steps ahead, you know, you'd risk just going out into, you know, too far into the future, the cone of uncertainty. But it's all about, you know, after 1 p.m., it might be coming up with a research piece, focusing on the last 2 weeks, it was the quarterly refunding announcement. What does this mean? You know, digest that. How is this going to trend into market prices on your asset classes? Or it could be something like working on your next business development deal. So in this seat, you have to, or I have to, you know, kind of put all those things together. So there's an element of structure, but then also an element of flexibility required.
Yeah.
You know, Matt, hearing you speak, it makes me think just how it's different. You know, we're in a larger corporate setting, so that's part of the difference in our days. I would say that the day for maybe somebody who's an individual credit analyst on our team probably looks a little bit different than mine. Well, first of all, here at Schwab, our credit research is independent from portfolio management. So our days look a little bit different in that regard. But just in terms of, you know, an analyst and what a credit analyst does, just because I think our listeners might be interested, is really an analyst follows a portfolio of credits, you know, whether that be a number of municipal issuers or corporate issuers, and they usually focus on a particular sector. So that might be, someone might be a healthcare expert or a bank expert or some consumer-driven corporate analyst, and they're responsible for really following a portfolio of credits. So that would be, you know, any sort of news event that comes up in the day, any sort of disclosure that's posted. We just went through, you know, a series of earnings updates, so that can be a very busy time of year. And so they're responsible for kind of keeping on top of their current credits, but there's also new issuers coming to market that our portfolio managers might be interested. So, you know, what they would get is, hey, you know, we're interested in XYZ. Can you give us a quick look and tell us, you know, maybe even within 30 minutes, it can often be a really short turnaround of what's your view on this credit? And that could be either in the primary market or secondary market. So it's kind of a mixture of maintaining what you have, but just these intermittent requests that come up during the day.
So Carol, take me through that a little bit in terms of having teams that are looking at these different portfolios. How are they keeping you updated? Like, how are you in real time, you know, understanding what's most important out there that you are the spokesperson for?
Right. So, you know, that is a challenge because I can't be a subject matter expert on everything, right? So I really try to have kind of a broad sweeping idea. You know, for me, I think what's really important is that we have weekly updates. So we have a credit committee, you know, where we discuss what are the main events of the week and go through, you know, important credits together as a team with our portfolio managers. We also have various investment discussions throughout the week, not just with our credit team, but that also involve our portfolio managers. But I would say we just have kind of we're in various offices. So I'm based in Chicago, but Schwab is, you know, traditionally based out of San Francisco. We also have a team in Naples, and we're really spanning the U.S. So what's been really helpful for us is that we have Bloomberg chats or Teams chats set up where we're kind of filling each other in on things throughout the day that we think are important to credit. And I think what my job is as head of research is to really parse out, okay, what's most important from all of this news I'm receiving during the day? And what do I think that somebody really needs to know? Okay, so where are the problems? Where are the strengths? And what are the big trends? So I kind of synthesize all that information so that I can communicate the key points. But I also need to know enough to ask the right questions to my team to make sure they're on top of credit. So it's a little bit of a challenge, but I also have really talented analysts, and I have managers that report to me that are really talented and subject matter experts. So it's not just on me. I've got a whole team.
That makes sense. So Matt, you mentioned I'm an independent fund trustee for Build, and I know one of the things that we do is give feedback back to the team as to what we need, you know, so like, okay, we want to shorten this part and, you know, we can read that on our own, but we really want to drill much more into where other areas are going. How is it that you're figuring out who your audiences are and what they want from you and how to deliver it? Is that something that you were kind of born with, or is that something you've been able to develop over time over your career?
Yeah, I'd say it's the latter. You develop it over time and you have to work at it. You know, for example, last week I was on Bloomberg, and you know, my natural tendency is if I'm asked a question, I want to go in and just feel like I've answered it fully, like I've given the consumer or the listener on the other side of the conversation all of the information that I think they need to make an informed decision. Well, in that setting, the actual answer you want to provide might be what I would consider 20 to 30% of complete, you know, knowledge drop. So you have to learn to kind of listen to what your audience wants and how to let them choose where to poke deeper, if you will. So I would say a formative experience in that was actually I took a detour mid-career. So I started on a Citigroup, then actually went to a startup that was building a in exchange to trade online ad impressions as a commodity, if you will. So there was a natural crossover in finance. But that led to a pretty amazing opportunity at Amazon to get involved with their advertising business back when it was 2013. Amazon wasn't a player in advertising. So it was a really good opportunity. But within that, I got to experience the Amazon culture along with meet a lot of people. We'll talk about that a little bit with mentors and such. But with that culture, I think one of the most valuable things I came out with from that is answer the question, use numbers, you know, be precise, but don't overshare, don't overprovide what's needed, just to check the box and be ready with more, but you don't have to overfill. So yeah, it was not, to go back to the original question, it was not born with it. It was learned in my case.
Right. What about you, Carol? Have you seen yourself growing or evolving in how you share information, and are you very like audience specific?
That's a great question. So I started out my career out of graduate school at S&P. So I was a municipal credit analyst. So one of the things that I had to do is regularly talk to municipal bond issuers. And I think the key thing, skill that you develop is learning how to talk about to people that don't understand credit or finance or markets. So I'd be, you know, interviewing finance director at a tiny school district, and they were very intimidated speaking to, you know, this Wall Street analyst. Little did they know is that, you know, I was, you know, in my 20s and, you know, new to the field, but I had to get in the habit of, you know, speaking to people in a way that would help them give me additional information. So be able to speak to their level and not go into too great of detail, or be able to explain complex topics. Like, I'm asking this question because we're looking at it in this specific way. And then I gave presentations to large audiences of people who weren't, you know, subject matter experts in fixed income. So I was forced to be able to really simplify these concepts. And I think that really in some ways is kind of a superpower, because a lot of us who are credit analysts love detail and love deep dives into credit and really explaining how complicated and nuanced the story is. Whereas I had to just really tell you it in the most basic terms.
Right, which I think tests your knowledge of whether you really truly understand what you're talking about, right? I feel like if you can simplify what you're saying in a way that actually helps people understand what you do, I think you're right. It's absolutely a superpower. My son is a junior in high school, and we're looking at colleges. And for some reason, all of a sudden, he's really engaged in neuroscience and the study of that. And that was my undergrad degree. None of my kids have ever had any interest in that. But now he's asking me very like specific questions about, you know, he's looking up these classes and like, oh, what did you learn in a class like this? And I'm like, you know, I'm like, what do I actually remember? And then how do I explain it in a way that, you know, like I could kind of dive into it, but like, what were like the major premise of that piece that would actually get him excited about it and answer it in a very short amount of time, because he's also a 16-year-old. So like his willingness to like sit and like listen to my diatribe on how excited I am about how the brain works, you know, is just not going to go over very well. So I feel like it's a developing power of myself as well, is to keep things bite-sized for folks. So Matt, you had mentioned influential mentors, and it sounds like maybe someone at Amazon or someone through your career has been somebody that you've relied upon to be successful in your career. Can you take us through that?
Yeah. So I think one that, like, for every, I think, life stage you're at or, you know, level you're trying to raise yourself up to, you might need a different mentor or a different guide. So for example, you know, a coach I really looked up to in or sports in grade school, high school, you know, I'd consider those like the first ones to, you know, get me the lift off that I've hopefully brought into my life. You retain those and you kind of pull them forward, but you also need to be, you know, seeking out, you know, partners for where you want to get to. So I always, you know, think about that. Where am I trying to get to, and who can map onto me? So over the last 10 years, 15 years, I mean, for one, you know, just think about the people you're spending the time with most and what they're bringing into your life. Those to me are the most important ones. I put my wife in that group. You know, she's helped me in so many levels. Both, I mean, you wouldn't think of in most, you know, spousal relationships, but career, just like things that I'm naturally not good at or aren't like innate talents, things I need to work on. She helps me a ton of that. So she's my best critic, but also my best supporter. And then there's other ones as well. Some of them from Amazon that I've retained, I now work with. So my partner who sits directly over here on my left, I've worked with him for 10 years, Dave Martin. Learned a ton from him as well, from operations, business decision-making, stuff, just things like that. You want to bring people like that into your life and continue, you know, learning from them every day. And then those people are also the ones that make these like projects and the work really enjoyable and worth it. And then there's a few other ones at Amazon, you know, I work with and under, like Jean-Luc Nahon, Colleen Aubrey. They really ascended the ladder. One of them is on the Colleen, especially, has ascended onto the Amazon's kind of C-suite executive team. They call it the S team, but just foundational people who are just exceptional at business execution and decision making, but also just good people to kind of foot to and just understand how to get the most out of life and understand your priorities.
Wonderful. I, you know, kind of have this visual of your career with these people that are in pockets throughout that, you know, continue to encourage you. And women in ETFs, and specifically on this podcast, we talk a lot about having sort of those informal relationships that end up being mentoring relationships, but they're kind of over time and you've never actually sat down and say, will you be my mentor? But you look back on your career and you're like, wow, they were influential in how I think about things. And then having the more formal, you know, mentors that can also be sponsors. And then probably what you were saying too, with, you know, having your wife and others, you've got these like board of advisors that sort of sit around you and know you well enough that when you come to them, they're like, they can call foul on like things that you're saying and be like, no, you know, you need to think about it differently. Or, you know, they're some of your biggest cheerleaders as well. So I love for our listeners to be thinking about it. I think sometimes people get caught up with like, I don't have a mentor. If you actually start to think about those people that challenge you and develop you, you do, and you have the opportunity to be those for others as well. What about you, Carol? Is there mentors over the course of your career that have changed and guided you to where you sit now?
Yes, and I would say that really what I kind of gained from having mentors in my life has really changed depending on where the stage in my career has been. So just thinking back, you know, growing up, I actually am from a small city in Wisconsin, where I certainly didn't know anything about asset management growing up, right? So, you know, my idea of finance is really our local bank branch or from the movies. So I really had no clue. So for me, just going from that kind of background and not really having a lot of women who've been on the path that I am today, it was really important for me to identify people who could help me and believed in my talents. So I went to the University of Notre Dame, and just having people help coach me to get to that place. And then when I was there, encourage me to take on, you know, those unpaid internships or help me with choosing to pursue. I got a master's degree at the University of Chicago. But, you know, a lot of that, yes, maybe I did on my own merit, but it was important for me to have that support system of people who could kind of show me the ropes on how to get those opportunities, as well as, you know, help me believe in myself. I've also had other interesting mentors. So I actually have a graduate degree in public policy, but they paired me up with a hedge fund manager for my mentor, which was pretty interesting. And I was thinking, how does this relate at all? But I remember really one piece of advice that she gave me, which was, in crisis, there is opportunity. And I think about that all of the time. So when I graduated from graduate school, it was 2010. So, you know, the market was still really recovering from the financial crisis at the time, which is part of the reason why I actually went into finance, because that was hiring and government was not at the time. But I really see that crisis as being a great opportunity for me. And I think about that frequently, you know, at work or when economic events happen or when challenges arise. Like, what is the opportunity here? What can I do now to be that problem solver or identify the opportunity? And so I think that's really has been the basis for my career, is looking for those moments. And then also I've had a number of great managers who worked as sponsors for me. So, you know, elevating my visibility and putting me in the room with the right people so that I can become known and be heard.
I love that line of, in crisis, there is opportunity. We were recently our sort of nuclear family of five. So we don't always together because we got kids, you know, in college and high school. but you try so hard to like protect your kids from so many things, right? You know, and like make it, you know, a beautiful growing up experience and all that. But when you get together and, you know, they're a little bit older and they're actually able to look back at their childhood some, it is those like crisis times where they grew or they noticed something about themselves or noticed something about us or, you know, saw their world differently or it shifted how they thought about people in the world. You know, my oldest daughter is in public health and I do think that some of the things that I would have wanted to protect her from as a child really influenced her like empathy for so many people that don't have access to health care. And, you know, I love that about her. But would I have chosen for her to be in sort of crisis moments where, you know, she's realizing these things? No. So I do think that kind of keeping in mind, you know, that piece across our careers and across our families is so important. So I love the line and I actually wrote it down in my notes. So thank you for that, Carol, because I don't think I've said it so succinctly with my own family. What I'm enjoying about this season is that we get to dive into so many careers. So as our listeners are going through and thinking about something like head of research, can you give us a little bit of a lowdown? And Matt, I'll start with you about what are some specific strengths or qualities that you would look at for somebody to be developing now so that maybe they could be sitting in your seat in a few years?
So I actually had the chance a few weeks ago. We put on a mini conference in my hometown of Jefferson City, Missouri, well attended, 200 people. But part of that was my master's program from Washington University of St. Louis, like sent a delegation of about 20 to 25 graduate students who were coming to me asking me in this program, you know, 10 to 15 years ago, how do I get here? I want to start my own firm. How do you do this? The short answer, and I think most of them didn't want to hear this, but it is going to take almost nights and weekends type of focus to get where you want to be. This is an interesting, like a deeply rewarding industry from a lot of angles. You know, chief among them, I think, is it attracts the most talented and best people, but that is also your competition. So this is the hardest chess game to play at. Don't be scared away by that. That's actually, I think, a valuable kind of intellectual exercise, and it never lets you down or keep like is you're never bored with this job, but you've always got to have that hunger, that work ethic. So if you can't do that, you got to figure out how to like, do I really want this, and turn on the dial, because someone out there is always outworking you, always one step ahead of you, and you just have to have that hunger. So I'd say number one, just like if you can do that and just turn it on and you're really passionate about this, that's first and foremost. And then I think the other skill that might be highly valuable is learning how to interpret news. So Carol mentioned you read the tape, you listen to the news, you see the headlines every day, but understanding how to put those together with your backdrop or your thesis, kind of how to link those stories together, because, you know, one quote I've heard to describe like the news feed, it's the first draft of history, if you will, and it's messy. So the initial kind of stream of events or financial market headlines, you might think you know how to react to them, but in reality, you have to develop the skill of reading between the lines, developing a bigger picture thesis to really be able to extrapolate meaning out of those and communicate the narrative to your colleagues, to your participants, and ultimately to your clients. So I'd say those two skills, just work ethic and then learn how to understand, form a thesis, and communicate a narrative.
Oh, really well said, Matt. Thank you. What about you, Carol? How would you be developing someone that wanted to replace you?
Well, I like how Matt was focusing on some of the soft skills, because that's also what I look at as well. I mean, I think that, you know, if you want to be a good analyst, sure, quantitative modeling, Excel skills, programming, the ability to read a financial statement, et cetera, you know, those are, you know, skills that you may need. But to be really successful, I see a few things. So curiosity and really just constantly being interested in learning, the ability to deal with ambiguity. So when we assign a credit rating or, you know, are communicating, we need to really have conviction behind our ideas, because there's a lot of unknowns, but you're not going to be convincing and influential if you don't have conviction behind your arguments. I also think what's helpful is the ability to be able to take feedback because we can have a lot of biases, I think, in the way that we look at markets or economic trends or our own personal experiences affect the way we may view certain credit conditions. And being able to accept challenges and work with your other teammates is also really helpful. And then I think, Matt, you touched on this too, but really being a good communicator is key. You can have the best opinion, but if you don't communicate it well, you're not going to have the influence you need.
Wonderful. Wonderful. I really like how you guys boiled this down. And Matt, while you were talking about the idea of it being a lot of hard work, I want to echo that. And also just this idea that it is a hard work amongst a lot of people that are really smart, and iron sharpens iron, right? You know, so you're going to be around people that are going to be sharpening you because you need to keep up and keep ahead of things that are going on. So thank you for that reminder. And Carol, it's funny that like I go through and I ask this question quite a bit on the show, and people don't always give the hard skills. You know, it's, you know, there's a lot of nuance in being able to pull information together, to be able to communicate, to be able to work with people, to have curiosity. But there's also just that idea of like, you've got to be able to know your stuff, and you've got to be able to, you know, have developed both through an education and through experience. So you guys knocked that out of the park. Thank you for your answers on that one. So, you know, as we think about all the ways that we are curious about this world and build our expertise within our field, we also just have this idea that we are curious about all things. And for me, it's reading. I love books for what they bring. For me, they bring an empathy to people that maybe I don't have direct experience with, or there's this idea of just being entertained, which with also like juicy questions about sort of life and, you know, different narratives. So I love asking this question. And Carol, I'll start with you, but do you have a book recommendation, maybe something you're reading or something that you've recently read to offer our listeners?
So I have two young kids, and every time they see me sitting down to relax, or especially with a book, they take that as an invitation to need me for something. But I will say one book that I did definitely take the time out to read this year, and I've actually read it twice, is a leadership book. It's called Leading Lightly, and it's by Jody Michael, who is a career coach. I actually used their career coaching service a few years ago, so that's how I became familiar with her. But the book is really about mental fitness, which I think is a great book because it shows you how to be in tune with your own emotions, see your own biases, and understand your own kind of mental script and reaction to, you know, certain triggers or people or events, and be able to kind of put on, let's say, a more helpful lens. And so, you know, by having this mental fitness, you're able to have a more optimal leadership style and get through your day with less stress, which is something I think we're all looking for.
Oh, wonderful. I have not heard of that book before, so I'll add it to the bookshelf as well as put it on my to-be-read pile. Thank you for that. What about you, Matt? Do you have a book for us?
Yep. So right now, I'm reading a book on the 1998 Southeast Asian financial crisis by Russell Napier. Highly recommended, especially for anyone in research, portfolio management, credit, foreign exchange involved today who didn't sit through and either sit in a seat and trade or, you know, have that job responsibility during this really important period or event within the broader global financial system that really gets kind of brushed underneath the big ones, if you will, like the global financial crisis of 2008 or COVID. But this was really the, in my opinion, the kind of the pebble that kickstarted, you know, all of this volatility that's coming through these waves in the financial system that keep materializing over our lifetimes. But going back and understanding what happened in chronological order from Russell's research notes that he was writing from his seat as an analyst and from the time period 1995 to 1998. He also runs a museum in, I believe it's in Edinburgh, Scotland. It's called the Library of Financial Mistakes. So he's a really interesting guy, great author. But it, like on top of just understanding, you know, market psychology, the ebbs and flows, understanding when you need to be a contrarian, when you need to go with the tide, all of that stuff. But also the big picture of history. And also this book specifically helps get across a lot about how the global dollar system works. That is really the key driver behind this system that I think a lot of us don't fully understand from our one narrow seat sitting in this industry and our education system, our background, bachelor's, master's. Like, a lot of programs just do not cover this. Theory, for some reason, doesn't really address how things work in practice. So it's a good blind spot to fill in, and also a really engaging narrative.
And give us the title again, Matt.
I think it's just called the Southeast Asian Financial Crisis. It's Russell Napier. It's on Amazon. You won't be able to miss it.
Awesome. Wonderful. Thank you. We will put a link for that in the show notes. Thank you both for your time today. It has been just a pleasure to speak to both of you, but also just get some great insights into both of your careers. Thank you again for being on the show.
Thanks, Christine.
Thanks, Christine.
And thank you, our listeners, for spending your time with us. I hope this is not just information, but you let it be transformational in how you think about your career. I'm rooting for you. If you're an Apple user, I'd really appreciate it if you took a few seconds to leave a rating and a review. Your ratings and reviews tell Apple that this is a podcast worth listening to. And in turn, your reviews will help We Talk Careers get in front of more listeners looking to succeed, just like you. And while you're there, go ahead and hit that follow button, because there's going to be another brand new episode and you don't want to miss it. Until then, keep thriving. Thank you for listening.